This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net.
Good morning, this is the KABU Morning News for Thursday, January 19th, 2006. I'm Carlos Chavez. The FBI has increased the reward for one environmental activist in California, where three more activists have been arrested. And in Oregon, one of the enviros jailed last week has been released on bail. Alito looks like a shoe-in for the seat on the Supreme Court vacated by Sandra Day O'Connor. And in Palestine, Hamas inched past the ruling Fatah party to win the election. Portland area weather, showers in the morning, rain by the afternoon, highs in the mid-40s to 50s. Tonight, cloudy with showers likely, temperatures in the high 30s to low 40s.
The Bush administration conceded that using hatcheries to supplement dwindling salmon populations is harming wild salmon species in Oregon. The administration plans to move away from the practice in favor of a more direct solution: catch fewer fish. James McNaughton, chairman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, announced the new policy yesterday at a meeting of salmon scientists. Many scientists have concluded that wild Pacific salmon will become extinct this century without big changes in how the harvest is managed. Scientists have long criticized hatcheries as producers of salmon that dilute the gene pool, spread disease, and compete with wild fish for food and habitat while being less able to survive in the wild. Gnaughton did not say how much the administration wants to reduce the wild salmon harvest or how many of the 180 federal, state, tribal, and private salmon hatcheries in the Columbia Basin it wants to close. Salmon have been severely reduced by a combination of human factors, from overfishing and development to hydroelectric power dams. Gnaughton, President Bush's top environmental advisor, outlined the new policy at the Salmon 2100 conference, where scientists gathered to consider new ways to prevent the extinction of wild salmon.
A suspected eco-saboteur was released on $1.6 million bail as he awaits a trial on charges that could put him behind bars for life. U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken ordered Daniel McGowan's release yesterday after a two-hour hearing. She imposed tight restrictions on McGowan's activities when he returns to New York City, where he studies acupuncture and works in a shelter for battered women. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kirk Engdahl asked Aiken to keep McGowan locked up, citing him as a flight risk and a threat to the community. Engdahl and McGowan was active in more than one secretive subcell of radical environmentalists who focus on disrupting biotechnology research. McGowan faces charges of conspiracy, arson, using a firebomb, and 13 arsons in connection with the fire set at Superior Lumber Company in Glendale and Jefferson Poplar Farm in Clatskanie, both in 2001. Four other activists have helped the government identify McGowan as a suspect. Engdahl said recorded conversations between McGowan and an informant revealed that McGowan threatened to encourage retaliation against a judge who sentenced activist Jeffrey Free Lures to more than 22 years in prison for torching vehicles at a Eugene dealership in 2000.
The FBI is offering a much bigger reward for information leading to the arrest of a Marin County animal rights activist. The original award of $50,000 went up to $250,000 yesterday. The increase comes after 2 years of searching for Daniel Andreas San Diego. The fugitive is suspected of coordinating the 2003 bombings of two East Bay companies. The blasts at biotechnology firm Chiron in Emeryville and health and beauty firm Shackley in Pleasanton did not cause any injuries. A group calling itself Revolutionary Cells took responsibility for the explosions, saying the firms were targeted for their connections to a research company that uses animals to test drugs. An FBI agent says he hopes the higher reward will motivate people to help.
Federal prosecutors alleged that three activists were cooking up homemade plastic explosives and planned to test their device the day they were arrested. The three were indicted yesterday. They face five to 20 years in federal prison if they are convicted of conspiring to use fire or explosives to damage property. Eric McDavid of Forest Hill, Zachary Jensen of Monroe, Washington, and Lauren Wiener of Philadelphia remain in Sacramento County Jail awaiting arraignment and bail amounts. They could enter a plea at their arraignment today. U.S. Attorney McGregor Scott said the potential stiff prison sentences should be a warning to other idealistic young people considering violent acts. The three are not known to have a connection to 11 alleged eco-terrorists who were indicted in Oregon last week. The FBI says such groups have claimed 1,200 criminal acts, causing more than $100 million in damage in the past 15 years, and are the Bureau's number two priority behind only international terrorism. Yet the three arrested January 13 did not know they were working with an undercover FBI informant or living in a cabin in a Dutch flat rented by the FBI and wired for audio and video surveillance.
The Portland City Council extended the drug and prostitution free zones yesterday. KBOO's Andy Seaton has the story.
In a unanimous vote, the Portland City Council extended the drug-free and prostitution-free zone ordinances until March 15th. Mayor Tom Potter said the committee working on the ordinances needs more time.
A lot of the concerns that I have are still out there, and I want to make sure that not only I am comfortable, that you folks will be comfortable with what we come up with.
The council also reviewed the recent project Homeless Connect, saying it was a great success. They served over 1,000 people, twice what they were expecting. Commissioner Eric Sten said the project will be repeated. However, Sten noted that the 10-year plan to end homelessness has already run out of money.
We are going to be bringing back in the bump report, which is an internal thing, but it's essentially when we adjust the budget to the city, a request from contingency for an additional $400,000 in funds that are essentially running the a fund to help with emergency rent assistance, to help with deposits and all these pieces. And what's happened is, though we are through the first year of the 10-year plan, it doesn't coincide with our budget. We're halfway through this year's budget, and a little under halfway through this year, we ran out of money that I thought was going to, based on historical trends, if we really, really ramped up our work last all year. And so the mayor has come forward and said he would like to bring that forward.
Mayor Tom Potter's 30-year visioning project ran into opposition and debate over its funding. The city is going to be spending $600,000 this year alone on visioning. $200,000 of that is for grants to city organizations. Commissioner Dan Saltzman questioned how those grants will be awarded. Lisa Wendt, the visioning project director, responded.
How do you prevent quite frankly, I would imagine will be some pretty flaky ideas that are designed to really sort of support a secondary objective than the community visioning itself. But, you know, here's a grant fund. Let's apply for it. Let's figure out how to fit our square peg into that round hole so we can get some money to support our arts fair or whatever. So how do you prevent the flakiness? How do you make sure that organizations who pretend to represent communities really do represent communities?
That's a great question. And we've been pretty straightforward in the application process itself in terms of asking organizations what their qualifications are for working with whatever population they propose to work with, and asking them to tie their strategy to their experience and to tie their budget to that strategy. We will also be working with them, so grants committee members will be assigned to each different project that's funded, so we're not going to give the money to them and then not be involved throughout the process. So the committee members and staff will be working with organizations throughout.
Despite his concern, Saltzman voted to spend the money, but Commissioner Randy Leonard did not.
I am concerned not so much by the process, but the money that's being dedicated to it, given the other needs. I would, in the best of all circumstances, if all things were equal and we had the money to provide the housing for the folks in the community that need it, if we had the money to help with health care for people that we've heard here today need it, this is something I could support. But I just honestly am struggling to be able to get to the place where I can support this, given the commitment it takes in terms of finances with all the various things that this city has on its plate.
Finally, the City Council voted to keep the Woodstock Community Center open. Portland's Park and Rec did not have enough money in their budget. but the Office of Neighborhood Involvement will be renting space there to make up the difference. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
The Los Angeles suburb of Maywood has passed a resolution on police immigration enforcement duties. The resolution promised to reject any future federal law mandating cooperation between police and immigration officials in the predominantly Hispanic city. In December, Costa Mesa voted to train police officers to help enforce immigration laws, a step that a handful of forces nationwide have taken since a federal law allowing it was passed in 1996. Currently, municipalities have the option of enforcing immigration law, though a handful of immigration reform bills being considered by Congress would make it mandatory. Maywood's police chief says his 43-officer force does not enforce immigration law and has no plans to do so.
A Mexican government agency is to issue some 70,000 maps marking main roads and water tanks for people wanting to cross illegally into the United States. The National Human Rights Commission says the maps will be aimed at cutting the death toll among migrants. U.S. advocates of tougher border controls have criticized the move, saying it will encourage illegal immigration. Relations between the U.S. and Mexico have cooled recently over U.S. plans to build a fence on parts of the border. The map plan is backed by Humane Borders, a U.S.-based organization which operates about 70 emergency water stations near the border. Launching the project in Mexico City, officials from Mexico's Human Rights Commission flatly denied they were trying to encourage greater migration. But a spokesman for the U.S. Homeland Security Department said maps would not improve safety for those trying to cross the border. Last year, the Mexican government issued comic book-style pamphlets warning of the dangers of illegal migration, while also giving advice on how to stay safe. This from the BBC.
Four Muslim men were detained without charge for months in the aftermath of 9/11, were eventually cleared of any connection to terrorism, but then deported to Egypt. Now they have been allowed to return to the U.S. to pursue their class action civil lawsuit against the U.S. government. They are charging unlawful imprisonment and abuse on behalf of 1,200 other Muslim and South Asian men rounded up and jailed following the attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Yasser Ibrahim, the first of the men allowed to return from Egypt under strict conditions, gave his deposition in New York Monday. The men who charged they suffered inhumane and degrading treatment in a Brooklyn detention center are being allowed to participate in the case under strict conditions, including confinement to their hotel rooms and a ban on their speaking to anybody outside the case for the duration of their stay. The three other plaintiffs are expected to arrive in the U.S. Over the next 2 weeks. Four other deportees are parties to the suit but are not expected to return to the U.S. for depositions. The plaintiffs charged that they were placed in solitary confinement and suffered severe beatings, incessant verbal abuse, and a total blackout on communication with their families and attorneys.
Officials said yesterday that men dressed in military garb who crossed the border and confronted Texas law officers this week were drug smugglers, not Mexican soldiers. Photos of what appeared to be Mexican troops in U.S. territory during the incident shocked many Americans, but to most Mexicans, the images just offered further proof that drug traffickers run rampant around the border area with military-style vehicles, uniforms, and firepower. Mexican presidential spokesman Ruben Aguilar told reporters in Mexico City it is known that these are drug traffickers using military uniforms, and they were not even regulation military uniforms. A U.S. law enforcement official said the FBI and other agencies found no evidence the uniformed men were Mexican soldiers. The case comes at a time of rising anger over border security, with Washington considering extending a wall along its 2,000-mile-long frontier with Mexico, an idea Mexicans better resent.
While the Bush administration defends its use of wiretapping to monitor the activities of the U.S. citizens, city officials in Santa Cruz, California, are coming under fire over revelations that undercover police were caught spying on locals planning a do-it-yourself New Year's parade. FSRN's Vinny Lombardo explores the serious questions that the case poses about the legality of the surveillance.
Council member Tony Madrigal is calling for an independent investigation to quell public criticism of local police surveillance on parade organizers.
Particularly because of our federal government's recent policy on unlimited access to our citizens. And I feel that this local incident has heightened our community's concern.
The council voted down Madrigal's proposal by a vote of 5-2, deciding instead to wait for results of a police internal affairs investigation. In the meantime, some 200 pages of documents resulting from the undercover operation were turned over by police. The surveillance was authorized by Deputy Chief Kevin Vogel, but other city agencies knew about it too, including Parks and Recreation, the city manager's office, and Mayor Cynthia Matthews. Local activist Rico Thunder took part in the parade planning.
When you send a message throughout the, you know, international community that America doesn't care about human liberties, civil rights, then it has a trickle-down effect on local law enforcement.
City officials contend the spying was done in the interest of protecting public safety, but ACLU attorney Mark Schlossberg says there needs to be reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before police can legally conduct surveillance.
From a public safety perspective, it makes no sense to infiltrate an organization rather than try and approach them and try and facilitate the thing.
Grant Wilson, a founder of Santa Cruz Art and Revolution, also helped plan the last night parade.
The police could have taken a very different tact and really been much more of a community police force and been supportive or at least been involved in a very visible way. And that would have been, I think, a much more positive influence than dividing the community in this way.
Many locals feel that if police will spy on peaceful parade organizers, then surely other groups have also been monitored. Another last night parade organizer, Kristen Phillips Madsen, confronted the council with photos documenting recent instances of local surveillance.
Photographs where there's an undercover officer that was in plain clothes and other kind of clothes up at UC during Tent University, during the anti-recruiter event, and at a labor event. So I think we really need to consider this is real.
ACLU attorneys will file another public records request this week seeking full disclosure of any police surveillance dating back to 2002. The police internal affairs investigation is to be complete in 3 weeks, at which time the city's public safety committee will brief the council on its findings at a special meeting set for February 13th. Vinny Lombardo, FSRN, Santa Cruz.
A report commissioned by the Pentagon claims that the U.S. Army is being stretched by its deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan into a thin green line in danger of breaking before the insurgents are defeated. In the report, an interim assessment of the Iraq war, the report states that without a clear strategy in Iraq, it's difficult to draft clear metrics for gauging progress. This may be why some senior political and military leaders have made overly optimistic or even contradictory declarations regarding the war's progress. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said he had not read the report. However, a group of senior Democrats issued their own report yesterday, accusing the Bush administration of putting our ground troops under enormous strain that, if not soon relieved, will have highly corrosive and potentially long-term effects on the force. The report called for an increase in deployable army forces of at least 30,000 troops. It argued there was a danger that America's enemies could exploit its vulnerable state.
U.S. senators yesterday accused President Bush of stonewalling a congressional inquiry into the government response last year to Hurricane Katrina, despite earlier promises to cooperate. The senators said that the White House had failed to make key officials available to the inquiry or turn over documents and internal government communications in the days before and immediately after the storm hit New Orleans and the Gulf Coast on August 29th. One document leaked this week showed the White House Situation Room was warned the same day that Katrina would likely lead to severe flooding and or levee breaching. On September 1st, however, President Bush told reporters, "I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees." A few days later, he also promised to cooperate with a thorough congressional investigation into the relief debacle that followed the storm in which tens of thousands of New Orleans residents were left stranded for days in the flooded city.
President Bush yesterday nominated one of the Justice Department's lead prosecutors in the Jack Abramoff corruption probe to a U.S. District Court seat. Noel Hillman, chief of the department's public integrity section and Bush crony, was nominated for the federal judgeship in New Jersey, where he served in the U.S. Attorney's Office under Michael Chertoff. Chertoff is now the Secretary of Homeland Security. White House spokeswoman Erin Healy said the president makes all his nominations in a timely manner and was ready to move forward with these. Until he's confirmed that Andrew Lurie, a career prosecutor in Miami, will lead the public corruption fighting office on a temporary basis. During a news conference earlier this month following Abramoff's guilty plea on corruption-related charges, Assistant Attorney General Alice Fisher, also a Bush appointee, said Hillman played an important role in providing leadership in the investigation.
The United States was accused of gangster tactics, and European governments were accused of turning a blind eye to outsourcing of torture. As a human rights watchdog concluded that the CIA conducted illegal anti-terror activities in Europe. Dick Marty said evidence pointed to a system of relocation, of torture, of terror suspects, and that reliable indications suggest secret interrogation centers may have existed in Europe. The document highlighted cases under legal investigation in Europe involving an Egyptian cleric, Osama Mustafa Hassan Nasri. Mr. Marty said he was scandalized that a few kilometers from where I live, people can be lifted by foreign governments. When someone goes on holiday in Macedonia, they are lifted by foreign agents. He added, if a government has to resort to gangster tactics, I say no. Marty revealed he had received flight logs that could show the route of CIA-sponsored flights. The report suggested that more than 100 terror suspects may have been transferred to countries where they faced torture or ill treatment in recent years. With more information coming to light over suspected CIA flight across EU airspace, Marty also accused some European governments of showing more interest in conducting leak inquiries than in pursuing the truth. This from The Independent.
According to the Boston Globe, a footnote in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's legal memo defending President Bush's domestic spying program appears to argue that the administration does not need Congress to extend the USA Patriot Act in order to keep using the law's investigative powers against terror suspects. The memo states that Congress gave Bush the power to investigate terror suspects using whatever tactics he deemed necessary when it authorized him to use force against al-Qaeda. When Congress later passed the Patriot Act, Bush already had the power to use enhanced surveillance techniques against al-Qaeda, according to the footnote. Thus, legal specialists say the administration is asserting that Bush would be able to keep using these powers outlined in the Patriot Act for al-Qaeda investigations, regardless of whether Congress reauthorizes the law.
The U.S. Supreme Court has blocked the execution of a Florida man to consider his appeal over the method used to carry out the punishment. Clarence Hill was to be executed yesterday for the 1982 murder of a Pensacola police officer. But the court wants to consider if the chemicals used in the execution cause pain, thus violating a constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Anti-death penalty campaigners say the move could delay other U.S. executions. Hill had been strapped to a gurney and intravenous lines were running into his arms late on Tuesday night, his lawyer said, when Justice Anthony Kennedy issued a temporary stay. The full court continued the stay on Wednesday. Oral arguments were set for the 26th of April, meaning it will likely be the summer before the court issues its opinion, Mr. Doss told the Associated Press. Lethal injection is the most widely used method of execution in the U.S., although some offer inmates the choice of alternatives like electrocution or the gas chamber. The exact combination of chemicals used varies, but the process usually involves three stages, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. The condemned inmate is injected with an anesthetic, which puts the inmate to sleep. Next follows Pavilion or pancuronium bromide, which paralyzes the entire muscle system and stops the inmate's breathing. Finally, the flow of potassium chloride stops the heart. This from the BBC.
President Bush, in the midst of a campaign to defend the secret surveillance program in the United States, called a news conference today. Bush also is expected to be asked about the impact of the election victory by the Islamic militant group Hamas in Palestinian elections. The president was to make an opening statement that previewed the themes of his State of the Union address next Tuesday. He also is expected to talk about the economy, the Senate's imminent vote on Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito, and the war on terrorism.
Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito is moving toward all but certain confirmation as the nation's 110th justice, with unhappy Democrats keeping up a drumbeat of criticism of the conservative judge while advising their leaders against attempting a filibuster. Without a filibuster, Alito will be confirmed as the replacement for retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who throughout her years in the high court often has been a key fifth vote on contentious social issues, including abortion, affirmative action, and the death penalty. Alito already has majority support in the Senate, with 51 Republicans and Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska already publicly supporting his confirmation. The confirmation debate on the Senate floor is continuing today, but Republicans in the White House are so confident that Alito will be approved by the Senate that they've already started congratulating him and setting up new lower court nominations for senators to consider.
Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections as Palestinian voters rejected the long-time rule of the Fatah Party, throwing the future of Mideast peacemaking into question. Palestinian leaders huddle to determine what role the Islamic militant group will play in governing the territories. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas will ask Hamas to form the next government, with his defeated Fatah party weighing whether to form a partnership or serve in the opposition. A Hamas government without Fatah as a moderating force would greatly complicate Abbas' efforts to restart peace talks. The Islamic militants, who carried out dozens of suicide bombings, and have said they oppose peace talks and will not disarm. Israel and the United States refused to deal with Hamas.
The U.S. military has released 5 Iraqi women and 400 other prisoners, handing them over to their families. It's a demand that was made by militants holding a kidnapped American journalist. But U.S. officials say the release was routine and not related to the kidnapping.
Thousands of anti-globalization protesters have marched through the Venezuelan capital Caracas at the start of the World Social Forum. The protesters shouted anti-war slogans, and many of them carried banners criticizing U.S. President George Bush. The annual meeting is seen as an ideological alternative to the World Economic Forum, attended by business leaders in the Swiss resort of Davos. Delegates will discuss fair trade, debt forgiveness, and indigenous rights. The country's president, Hugo Chavez, is attending the six-day forum. Some 10,000 people from 54 countries joined the anti-war march. Peace activist Cindy Sheehan addressed the crowd, saying the U.S. needed to bring its troops home immediately. Other speakers will include Argentine Nobel Prize winner Adolfo Perez Esquivel, Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, and former French First Lady Danielle Mitterrand. Organizers say more than 60,000 people have registered to take part in the seminars, workshops, and panels to be held across the capital over the next 6 days.
Large bundles of cash meant for the Iraqi reconstruction were stashed in filing cabinets, handed over without receipts, and gambled away, a report has found. The audit by the U.S.-appointed inspectors paints a picture of the chaotic misuse of millions of dollars of funds. The lack of oversight had a tragic outcome in one case when a hospital lift supposed to have been fixed crashed, killing 3 people. The report said U.S. post-war planning was limited by a desire for secrecy. There were no detailed overt preparations for the reconstruction of Iraq in the run-up to the 2003 invasion to avoid the impression that the U.S. government had already decided on intervention. Military intervention. One official kept $2 million in a bathroom safe, while another allegedly stole $100,000 from a colleague's unsecured stash to balance his own books. Payment was handed over for projects without any official contract being drawn up or checks on the work carried out. More than 2,000 contracts were found to be at fault. In one case, a contractor was paid $100,000 to refurbish an Olympic swimming pool. One U.S. military assistant is said to have gambled away up to $60,000 while accompanying the Iraqi Olympic team to the Philippines. Wayne White, a former U.S. State Department official, told the New York Times, What's sad about this is that considering the deconstruction in the country with looting and so on, we needed every dollar for reconstruction. This according to the BBC.
The KBOO Morning News for Thursday, January 26, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. Carlos Chavez is anchoring this morning with me. KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. And Boone Rivas is on the board right now. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Carlos Chavez.
And we welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email at amnews@kboo or drop by the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. The KBOO website is www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on Transmitter K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on Transmitter K220HR. Be sure to join us this evening at 5 o'clock, solid hour of solid news on the KBOO Evening News program. Portland area weather, showers in the morning, rain by the afternoon, highs in the mid-40s to 50s tonight, cloudy, showers, likely temperatures in the high 30s to low 40s. Coming up on KBOO this morning, right now at 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Her co-host is Tom Carney, and the topic is the Telecommunications Act of 2006. At 9, Julie Sabatier hosts a pilot show called DIY Portland. Guests include women who worked on the book PDX, Super Crafty, and a teacher of a sewing class called Anarchist Tanks and Tees. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's part one of a series on the destruction of the World Trade Center, a lecture by David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor and other books. At 10:30, Julie Bernard's guest on Art Focus is gallery director Marjorie Hirsch. She'll discuss the upcoming NC Carved Ceramic Conference in Portland and related exhibitions at the Frost Art Center. Join us at 11 for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Community calendar for Thursday, January 26th. There will be a voter-owned elections in Portland information meeting tonight from 7:30 to 9 p.m. to educate and discuss the voter-owned elections here in Portland. This event will be held at Hannah B's Restaurant at 3969 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Everyone is invited to this informational event. Again, that's this evening, and for more information, contact Lori at lamcgil2@yahoo.com. The Multnomah County Library will be holding a Valentine Zine Social on February 5th from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Come swap your zines, make valentines, drink warm beverages, eat sweets, and socialize. This event will be held at the Central Library in downtown Portland at 801 Southwest 10th Avenue. For more information, call 503-988-5234. Home Free, a program of Volunteers of America for Women and Children Surviving Domestic Violence, has opportunities for compassionate women to assist in various program areas, including working in the children's program, doing advocacy with women, answering the hotline, restraining order room advocacy, and co-facilitating support groups. Training will be provided starting February 1st. For more information, call Samantha at 503-771-5503 to reserve your space. Join the Bicycle Transportation Alliance for better biking and a free ride. When you become a member of the BTA before February 1st, you'll receive with your membership a complimentary entry to the Worst Day of the Year ride. This is an 18 to 40 mile ride around Portland on February 12th and is a chance to laugh at the elements and join hundreds of other riders for a celebratory ride with yummy rest stops and warm soup and bread at the finish line. Proceeds of this event benefit the Community Cycling Center. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a statewide group for bicyclist rights. For more information, please call 503-226-0676, extension 15. You've been listening to the Community Calendar for Thursday, January 26. This is Alicia Olson with KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.